In presiding.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. How are we doing today?
Great.
All right. And before we get started this morning, I just wanted to let everybody know that Justice Stiglitz sends her apologies for not being able to be here in person today. She is participating. She's listening remotely, but without video, and will be participating in our decisions as well. Mr. Polzenberg, do you wish to retain any time for rebuttal?
I'll try to save 10 minutes, but you've given us so much time. I'm here to answer any questions.
We were trying to be ahead of the curve on this. So.
There you go.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, Dan Polzenberg for the petitioners in these four cases. So this constitutional challenge to NRS 629.620 would seem to be easy. It raises the same issues, at least as it has to do with civil discovery and litigation, as in the Lyft case. The statute and Rule 35 conflict when it comes to observers, whether attorneys can be observers, how you can record and what means to record, and even the different treatment of neuropsychological examinations. But plaintiffs raise a slightly different issue. They say that the Lyft case set out a roadmap for how to get around the separation of powers issue. And they say that they've complied with that. Now, I don't read the Lyft case that Machiavellian, but let's look at what they say. They say where the statute goes beyond, because these are the things that the court pointed out in the Lyft opinion. I don't think it was meant to be a roadmap, but it said, look, the statute there was clearly procedural as opposed to substantive for separation of powers because it dealt with civil litigation. It didn't go beyond that. And then also that it didn't create any kind of cause of action or claim for relief. So the same lawyers went to the legislature yet again and came up with a different statute that went a little further than 52.380. But I don't think either of those two efforts were enough. I don't think this is a statute that applies generally. This is clear from the testimony in front of the legislature, from the efforts that were made to change Rule 35 in court. And if we had to change other things, so much the better. So it's clearly not a universal statute. The statute, every time someone brought up an objection to the statute, it was amended to create another exception. Title 5 for juvenile justice, Title 14 for criminal procedure, 15 for crimes and punishments, 39 for mental state, Chapter 432B for child abuse and neglect, and a section in 125A having to do with child custody. And it really doesn't apply generally even outside those exceptions. The examples that were raised in the legislature, well, this could come in workers' comp. And in fact, they argued, this is how we do it in workers' comp. And this would come in if you were trying to get your pilot's license. Well, no, that's the problem with this broad statute that claims to apply to things. It wouldn't apply to workers' comp. Workers' comp has sections in Chapter 616C on medical examinations and regulations regarding them. Pilot's licenses, yes, you have to have a medical certificate, and that's governed by the Federal Aviation Administration.
Mr. Polzenberg, what about the concept that this notion of bodily autonomy, it creates a substantive right because it is protecting people's right to bodily autonomy? So that's the versus the procedural analysis.
Yeah. I don't buy it. Let me tell you why. The Rule 30, 35 examination issue goes all the way back to federal court adoption of Rule 35 and allowing medical examinations under Rule 35 under the Rules Enabling Act of 1934. And that was tested in Sivak versus Wilson. This court cited Sivak versus Wilson in the Lyft opinion. And there the fight was whether the idea that a federal court could order medical examinations, was that procedural or was that substantive? Before the Rules Enabling Act, federal courts used whatever civil procedure was used in the forum. Illinois did not allow medical examinations. So the fight was, can courts order medical examinations? And the United States Supreme Court said, yes, that's procedural, because substantive statutes look at creating rights and how to remedy them, and procedural statutes, and this is the same language out of Lyft, talk about how to go about enforcing those. And the United States Supreme Court said just the idea of whether or not to have a medical examination is procedural. Now, they point out it was a 5-4 decision. Four justices dissented. Justice Frankfurter, in a very short dissent, said federal courts can't order medical examinations. It's been the law since Botsford in 1891. So this conflicts with what is already the law and the limitations of federal courts. So, but nobody brings that up anymore because Sivak versus Wilson established Rule 35 examinations are procedural. Why do I bring up that long history? Because I think the real fight, if we're talking about bodily autonomy and integrity, would be, do you have medical examinations at all? And the courts say, no. This court said in Lyft that the IME is the process to bring about the litigation. The U.S. Supreme Court said that there may be different sanctions that would apply in a medical examination, but we're not even talking about whether to have medical examinations. We're talking about the particulars of the process to do that.
Mr. Poulsenberg, at what point, though, can the legislature pass laws that protect people, right? So could the legislature say in any medical examination a person is entitled to have an observer and take notes?
I don't think if it conflicted with the rules, Rule 35, that they could do that. And I think that's what that comes down to. The separation of powers issue is coming up with a conflicting statute where there's a pre-existing rule properly promulgated by this court to establish how procedures are going to be done. Let's do a hypothetical. Let's say we had somebody who got the legislature to pass a statute that said any sworn statement, oral or written, can be changed for 7 years and nobody can comment on it. Now, that would apply to insurance applications, that would apply to employment applications, but it would change our rules on depositions and answers to interrogatories. So it would be, I would say, just as this statute is, maybe the legislature can determine things generally, but as applied to the conflict with Rule 35, it has to give way to Rule 35.
Well, Mr. Poulsenberg, over here.
Thank you. That echo's been bothering me since 1992.
So now I lost my train of thought. No. But isn't it true that if the legislature has passed a substantive statute, then to that extent, the rules have to give way to the substantive statute? There may be a conflict, but it's the rules that give way in that circumstance, not the statute.
If it's truly substantive, I don't think right. This is truly substantive. I think the idea of having it a general statute is an artifice. It's clear from the legislative history that the main goal here was to create a statute that conflicted with Rule 35. The same lawyers.
Really, where'd they say that in the legislative history?
Well, I've watched every minute of those recordings, and you can see where the lawyers say. Now, remember, you have to say it's substantive. And when they talk about things like workers' compensation examinations, they say...
Well, the point there was Mr. Bochanas was pointing out that, yes, it already happens in workers' comp exams that they're allowed to have an observer, and that's worked just fine.
So if it works just fine, my first question is, why do they need a statute that changes it in that context? Look at what they presented in the legislative history. They presented rules of civil procedure that allow observers from Arizona, from California. This is a procedural rule as applied to the courts.
But you don't disagree with, or let me put it this way, you're not challenging NRS 2.120, are you?
Remind me what that is.
Okay. So sub 2 of that says the Supreme Court is to regulate original and appellate civil practice and procedure in judicial proceedings of all courts of the state. Such rules shall not abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive right and shall not be inconsistent with the Constitution of the state.
I'm saying if it's truly substantive, that we can't change that. This reminds me of Burke versus Choi, which was argued day before yesterday in the United States Supreme Court. Are the affidavits of merit in a medical malpractice case procedural or substantive? And you don't have to worry about that so much.
Not today.
How do you define substantive for purposes of your argument?
Substantive has to be really to create a right. And that's why my long discussion of Sibbok versus Wilson. Because there the U.S. Supreme Court agreed that the idea of having a medical examination as part of litigation is procedural. It doesn't violate substantive rights.
But they were not considering statutes that conferred a right that, if invaded, would support the imposition of a fine or a remedy for its violation.
Well, so I don't think that remedy that they added, and this goes to the second point I haven't gotten to yet, of whether them creating some kind of remedy suddenly makes it into a substantive claim for relief. But what they're providing are things that our state district courts can do under Rule 37 and 26. And look what they're saying. It's a violation of the statute. So would it be that you took a medical examination and there's a right not to have a medical examination? No, the statute doesn't go that far. I think then we'd have a different argument about whether it's substantive. The violations would be you didn't give 21 days notice, you didn't allow an observer, you didn't allow a recording. Those are not the types of rights that rise to substantive rights where you have to have a claim for relief. I think what this court was talking about...
Their argument is that there's a core substantive right, essentially of privacy, that if you're going to be subjected to somebody who's not your doctor examining you, that is a violation unless these protections attend that interview or exchange or examination. So my struggle here is I understand it was governed by the Rule 35 that was adopted, but now they're saying there is an invasion here of a right we want to protect and we want to give more protections than are recognized in this procedural rule. So why is that not a substantive? I get that they can't just change procedural rules, but they're saying there are remedies for the invasion of these protections.
Well, first of all, I think that this is procedural. It's not substantive. And the remedies they're giving are the same remedies that a court would look at in determining if there's a violation of any of the provisions of Rule 35. Attorney's fees, courts can give attorney's fees under 37. A set fine of $1,500, can a district court do that? I've seen district courts impose fines for violations of orders. It can be a restriction of the admission. It's right in the statute, the admission of the evidence.
How does your due process right of defendants fit into the substantive versus procedural labeling?
I think the due process argument goes more to the neuropsychological examination, and that no neuropsychologist will do a test if the raw data and the scoring is made public. I think that is a constitutional argument, but I don't really think it's part of my separation of powers argument that this court has asked for argument on.
Mr. Polzenberg, I'm sorry.
Just one follow-up. Positing that the right of a defendant to have a plaintiff medically examined when the plaintiff is seeking damages for alleged medical injuries is rooted ultimately in due process.
We have argued that. And I think if the courts were to draw different distinctions, there would be equal protection issues. But that's not so much the issue we have here. The issue we have here is the separation of powers argument, which I think it's a facial argument, but it's as applied. So I think the legislature can create this right when it has to do with insurance, with workers' compensation, all the areas where they are allowed to pass statutes, but applying this to Rule 35 creates a conflict. Sorry, Your Honor.
Would we be able to, because we have a duty to try to construe statutes constitutionally when possible, would we be able to save the statute if we were to sever out the parts that don't involve civil litigation, such as the contractual obligation or any other type of obligation?
Absolutely, and that's why I'm saying it's only unconstitutional, it's violative of separation of powers when it's applied to civil litigation. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Schnitzer, my understanding was you were the only one that were going to be arguing on behalf of respondent.
Yes, I've been voluntold to take this on for everybody.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. Chief Justice Hernan, Jordan Schnitzer on behalf of all of the respondents. When the court considers a constitutional challenge, statutes are presumed to be constitutional, and a constitutional challenger must make a clear showing of invalidity. That's from the Tam case. Here, the petitioners cannot make that showing, because the sole question is whether the statute confers substantive rights. We know that the legislature has the power to preserve, protect, and create substantive rights, and the judicial rules, as Justice Kagan said, may not abridge or modify any of those substantive rights. And the history and the content of this statute shows that it's substantive. While the Lyft case was a reminder, maybe a lesson about the limit on procedure that the legislature can do, it was not a limit to the legislature on creating substantive rights. In their briefing, the petitioners try to create tension by framing the passing of this statute as the separate branches being adversaries, but each branch is not an enemy, co-equal is not combative, and the legislative and judiciary's role is to work together to ensure that the government functions effectively. And effective government includes recognizing when another branch has done its job properly. Here, the legislature did its job, as the federal court in Daly persuasively outlined. It created a substantive right. It listened to the citizens, the concerns. It proposed a bill based upon those concerns. It heard opinions from various people, the NJA, to be sure, but also from the opposition. It heard from the Chamber of Commerce, the Resort Association. It heard from the psychologists, and ultimately voted 80% in favor, which is very rare in today's political climate to get such overwhelming will of the people. And the text alone shows that this was intended to be substantive by the legislature. It talks about it's a bill relating to health care. It says right in the preamble that it's establishing substantive rights. And it says in subsection 1 that the people retain several rights. So it's clear the legislature knew what they were voting on, and 80% agreed to enshrine those substantive rights. The substantive right was created not just by their intent, but by the content of the statute itself. there's four ways a statute can be substantive for separation of powers purposes. Any of the four is enough to pass constitutional muster. Here we think we have all four. First, it codifies a pre-existing substantive right that was historically applied. It applies not just in discovery, not just in litigation. Third, it creates a private right of action. And fourth, it involved careful policy considerations of the legislature that applies outside just judicial business.
Mr. Schnitzer, who does it create a private right of action against? Like, there's a violation. Are they suing the judge?
Well, I don't think we're suing the judge. Anybody's suing the judge. I don't think that's before the court in terms of who that's against, but when I read it, I see it as it would apply to the examiner, could apply to an insurance company outside the context of judicial business. It could apply to an employer who's forcing an exam. And those are the types of people that I would anticipate it applies to, certainly not the judge. And then, you know, there's judicial immunity issues that obviously not before the court today.
Well, dovetailing on my colleague's question, who has the duty to act on this alleged substantive right that's conferred under the statute?
The duty to act, mm-hmm. meaning the duty to ensure that the right is followed through on.
Right.
The option is on the examinee to say, I want to have this observer, I want to have an interpreter, I want to take notes, I want to video. And so they have
the right. Who does the examinee sue if that doesn't happen?
Right. If they're forced to go through it without it, again, I think they sue the examiner. They can sue the entity who's enforcing it. So it could be an insurance company, could be an employer. Those are the types of situations I would foresee being sued by that.
So, Mr. Schnitzer, I guess, sorry.
No, it's
for some reason, the way the sound works.
It echoes, yes.
Anyway. My question is, how do you respond to, you know, kind of where Mr. Polzenberg started? Look, we already addressed this in Lyft. We already addressed the statute on that issue. And isn't this just putting lipstick on a pig? He didn't say that, but I'll sort of rephrase it.
Sure. So it's not. It's a very different statute. And I think the court has to look at it on its own merits and say, is this statute in and of itself constitutional? And have they met their burden to say it's unconstitutional? Does it have similarities? Sure. But you have to look at NRS 2.120 that you referenced earlier, which is when you have a procedural rule and a procedural statute that encroaches on separation of powers. But when you have a substantive statute that's passed and Lyft outlined, and maybe it wasn't a roadmap, but it was certainly an education, it was certainly a lesson, and the legislature listened and applied those items and created a substantive right, and by overwhelming majority.
If it's a substantive right, why are there so many exceptions?
So all of the exceptions applied were based upon public safety, emergent public safety, and exigent circumstances. So those were the situations where the exceptions applied, not on items when 21 days, when there was enough time to give notice.
And what about Mr. Polzenberg's argument that the statute really doesn't create any new remedies, that the court doesn't already have available to them for the violation of this substantive right?
That presupposes that the issue is arising in litigation that's already taking place, right? And that's the whole purpose, is that this applies outside of litigation, because someone who's going in for a first-party IME on a contract case that's not in litigation, they don't have the ability to go to the court without this statute. Someone who's going in for an employment exam doesn't have the ability to get remedies from a court. And so that's actually proves my point, which is this is substantive because it applies outside of court judicial business.
Well, what if we were to sever the statute and have it only apply to proceedings outside of civil litigation?
So I don't think the court can do that respectfully, because the statute is either substantive or it's not.
And are you saying we don't have the authority to sever a statute to save its constitutionality to the extent it is constitutional?
In the general sense, the court does. But in the context of separation of powers and substantive versus procedural, if the statute is substantive, even if it's intertwined, and we have a lot of that citing in our briefing, even if it's intertwined with procedural, then the substantive rule, substantive law overrules the procedural rule.
But we have a duty to try to construe it as presumptively constitutional, and if we can sever it to save portions of it so that it doesn't encroach on our branch of the government, are you saying that we can't do that?
I don't believe you can in this case, and I would cite to State v. Dredge, the Utah case, which says sometimes a rule is so intertwined with a substantive right that the court must view it as substantive, and so if even though it's intertwined, even though it applies, it may interfere with that. If it's a substantive right, it applies even in the procedural aspect. And we also cited to a case called Capel out of Florida, where the court there said, we have consistently rejected separation of powers challenges where the procedural provisions were intertwined with substantive rights. So my position is, in this case, the court cannot separate the two. If it's substantive right, it applies even with respect to the procedure in the court.
Do you have a definition to offer of substantive in this context? It is puzzling to me because procedural is the same word as process. It's a derivative, and due process is what, by virtue of the rules of procedure, the court is trying to afford those who come before it. And so this dichotomy of procedure versus substantive, it's a useful way to talk about it, but what do those two words really mean in this context?
I don't disagree with Mr. Polsenberger on that point. I think something that's substantive creates duties, rights, and responsibilities. And that's what this statute does, is it creates rights. It codifies pre-existing rights. You know, we look back, 1909, Nevada case, Murphy, where the claimant was allowed to bring a doctor and their lawyer to an examination. And so it's codifying things that have existed for a long time. So it's maybe not creating, but re-enshrining those rights. It's also creating the right to bring causes of action when this is occurring outside of the judicial business. And it's actually gives, even if it occurs within judicial business, it gives the right to bring a separate cause of action for the damages, for the attorney's fees, for the $1,500 for actual damages. And so this statute does create rights, and it creates duties on examiners to allow the people to have their substantive right, to have an observer, to have an interpreter, to have a recording and have a fair process.
What's the substantive right that's being protected?
Substantive right is the right to certainly bodily autonomy.
But wouldn't that go to the core of whether or not we could do IMEs in the first place? And that's already been resolved, correct?
So,
as a procedural tool for discovery.
Sure. So that's where it gets into the fourth point I had made, which is the legislature balanced policy considerations, which is should an insurance company have the right to do an exam in certain situations? They could have said no exams ever, and that would have been substantive, but they didn't. They balanced that policy consideration against, if we're going to allow these exams and these exams happen, let's have some fairness in it, let's give them some comfort, a right to a doctor, and make sure there's a fair process. So I think it's a policy balance consideration that the legislature did, and that's their prerogative.
But once the legislature says you can have IMEs, then the courts have to be the ones to manage the procedure by which those are conducted.
Sure.
Why does, and we have a procedure, it's Rule 35. And you won't disagree that the statute, the 629-620, is irreconcilably at odds with Rule 35, correct? We can agree on that?
I agree with that.
Okay. And so if Rule 35 is procedural and 629-620 comes in and starts meddling with that rule and telling the courts how to conduct the procedures of their courts, how is that different than what we held in the Lyft case?
Well, four reasons. Because it codifies pre-existing rights. It applies not just in discovery. It creates a private right of action. And it very clearly, when you look at the legislative history, showed a balance of policy considerations. And so that's very different than Lyft, where that statute, the 52 statute, was very clearly aimed directly at Rule 35, Rule 35 only. This statute applies in the broad context, and all of the case law supports that once it applies broadly outside the context of just judicial business, it's substantive, and that's the legislature's prerogative. And the procedure rule has to give way to the substantive statute in that case.
Is it the case that, like, if people go in front of the legislature and say substantive enough times that it becomes substantive and not procedural? Because it sort of seemed like that was what was going on.
Sure. I don't think the lobbyist just saying substantive is in and of itself enough to make it substantive. I would not make that argument. But what the legislature voted on is enough to make it substantive, because in the preamble, it says this is to create a substantive right. So that's what the proponents of it were trying to create, and that's what actually made it into the preamble. And when you look at subsection 1, when it says retains the right, that is the legislature actually voting and saying this is our intent. We're not just listening to them. We're putting this into the language that we're voting on. So that's why I think it's not just about what, you know, Mr. Bochanis and Ms. Brazier testified about it. It's about what the legislature actually voted on.
I have a question somewhat related to what Justice Bell was asking about, but part of the argument was the statute's plainly substantive because it lays out a cause of action, and that it lays out the elements of a tort. So exactly in your mind, how does it do that? In terms of duty, breach, causation, damages, who is, if a defendant through an insurance company and counsel asks for a neuropsych without an observer, I mean, is the ask a violation of the duty? If the court grants it, is that the violation? If an examiner does it in relation to a court order, exactly how does it lay out a cause of action which would make it a substantive statute?
Sure. Happy to answer that. One thing I would say is, again, your question presupposes this is only taking place in the context of litigation.
Right.
It could also apply outside, and so no, the ask for an examination is not a violation. It is when the examinee asks to have an observer, says, gives notice, we're going to have an observer, I'm going to record it, I need an interpreter, whatever it may be, and then they refuse to do it and they go through with the exam without allowing for those items in the statute. That is the breach. And sorry.
But you get the rub there, right? Like if a court orders the exam to take place in a certain way and the examiner is like, I've got a court order telling me I got to do this, am I in violation somehow of the statute so that there's going to be an action brought against me if I'm complying with a court order?
I think that would be...
I think the statute just says if somebody's compelled to undergo an exam that violates the prescriptions of the statute, then they can bring the cause of action.
I think that would be a strange and bizarre situation if this court says it's substantive and it applies, and then a district court judge said, I'm going to ignore this court's holding. I think there would be, you know...
Judges do that sometimes.
No. fair enough. You know, I think that obviously opens up opportunities for petitions, for writs, and for other items. I don't know that we can say it's not substantive because a judge might ignore what the Supreme Court might say. If it's substantive and the Supreme Court says so, I don't know. I don't know what the remedy is for a judge ignoring the Supreme Court.
What about the countervailing concerns about why Rule 35 exists in the first place, meaning why observers and recordings are disfavored? There's a whole body of academic papers that talk about the invalidation of the exam, perhaps changing the conduct of the examinee. There's federal courts that have weighed in on the dangers of allowing this type of monitoring of these exams. And then the advisory committee notes itself to NRCP 35 goes into those concerns. So what about those countervailing concerns?
Are you talking about only in the neuropsychological context?
Well, of IMEs, or whether it's psychological or neuropsychological, I don't think that the academic research distinguishes it across the board. Sometimes they do, but what about the concern of the negative impacts of having these things, which I think is the purpose of Rule 35?
Yeah, I think a lot of the psychological, neuropsychological concerns are overblown. They've said repeatedly no neuropsychological expert will do these exams. I just got a report this week from a neuropsychologist who did an exam with an observer, and he just put a footnote on there that said, I didn't want to do it this way, but this is what the court made me do. And surprisingly, they didn't quit their business. They kept going. And so, I think what you're kind of getting at is a due process question. A fair exam is not an unfair trial to the defense. The right to a fair trial goes both ways, and I think the legislature can certainly weigh in and say, whether it's in judicial business or outside judicial business, these exams can have far-reaching applications and consequences for these people, and they should have the right to have a neutral party there who's not just being paid by the other side.
So, Mr. Schnitzer, let me jump in here. You've brought up a couple times about some that's being a historical right, and it was argued in some of the briefing.
Sure.
Before the 2019 amendments to our rules of civil procedure, our rules didn't address observers or recording at all in the rule on its face. And so whatever may have happened before 1935 under common law, I'm not that familiar with, but I'm familiar with the rules of civil procedure. So what was happening before the 2019 amendments to the Nevada rule that would support this being a historical practice?
Yeah, so, historically, you go back to the United States Supreme Court, 1891, in the Botsford case, the defendant had no right to an examination of an injured person. They thought one's dignity was very much invaded by compulsory poking and prodding. And then as courts started allowing these exams, common law people were allowed to bring all types of observers, lawyers, doctors, family members. We cited a Tennessee case, the ALR talked about that we cited and actually attached from 1959. We cited a Williams case from 1915 from Tennessee, a case called Whiteville versus Milwaukee, 1884, Wisconsin. We had a whole list of them, and probably most pertinent to this court is Murphy versus S-Pacific, 31 Nevada, 120. It was a 1909 Nevada Supreme Court case where the party was allowed to bring a physician of their own choosing as well as their lawyer. And so that was certainly a historical practice here in Nevada where people were allowed to bring observers to these exams.
Thank you.
I did want to, one other thing that Mr. Polsenberg had mentioned, he said that the legislature, all of the other states that we talked about dealt with rules of civil procedure. That's partially true, but there's also Oklahoma had done it through statute, and several other states had done it through case law through their courts. So it wasn't simply everybody doing rules of civil procedure. So unless the court has any other questions, I'll run.
Have there been, I'm familiar with the, sorry.
It's okay.
I saw Judge Silva's decision from the federal court in the Daly case, and she found that it was substantive. Have our other federal judges addressed that issue? I think she has a subsequent decision saying the same thing.
Right. My understanding and from what I've seen is all of the subsequent ones have come from, magistrates have cited to her decision. And certainly, I think her decision was well-reasoned and very persuasive. And I could have probably just stood up here and read her decision. It would have been a great job, but I think it's persuasive.
What, if any, concern do you have on the idea of general and specific relationships between statutes or statutes and court rules? I know when we talk about conflicting statutes, a little different from a conflicting statute and court rule, but I think the same idea of general specific persuasion kind of applies to that as well. So here it seems like both Rule 35 and the statute speak in general terms about physical and mental examinations, except in one respect, and that is that Rule 35 specifies on neuropsych examinations, you can only have an observer if the court finds good cause. So with regard to that part of the rule being very specific, does that outweigh the more general provisions of the statute or no?
No, absolutely not. Number one, I would say I don't think the statute is more specific than the rule because it talks about mental exams that encompasses psychological, neuropsychological. I know sometimes they make a distinction between the two. Do you have the board certification? Do you not? I don't think that's a real big distinction. But more importantly, when you're looking at substantive versus procedural, and certainly Rule 35 is procedural, any aspect of it, and our position is 629.620 is substantive, and substantive is always going to overrule procedural, whether it's more general or more specific. Any other questions? Thank you.
Oh, thank you.